I'm Lina Ahmadu. Welcome to Health Chat. It is a common procedure for newborn boys in some parts of the world. In other parts of the world, it is done as a rite of passage from boyhood to manhood. On the show today, we will discuss male circumcision, a surgical procedure consisting of the removal of the skin covering the tip of the male sex organ. Male circumcision is performed as a religious ritual, a family tradition for personal hygiene or preventive health care. One of the oldest and most common surgical procedures performed globally, the World Health Organization estimates that 1 in 3 males worldwide are circumcised. But not everyone finds circumcision necessary. So first, we asked your thoughts on male circumcision and if you would circumcise your child. Here are some reactions from Kinshasa in the DRC.
Circumcision.
Since the world began, circumcision is the way a man is created. Every man before meeting a woman must be circumcised. One must cut his foreign skin between the age of 6 and 10. But I don't know how to explain that the man waits until the last minute when he's an adult and not circumcised.
It's necessary that the parents circumcise their children when they're still young. As they grow, they must be strong and in good health. You can't let your boy grow up uncircumcised. It's not right, because a child born from an uncircumcised parent is always weak. There's a difference between us circumcised and the uncircumcised. You will see that the child is always weak.
Me, man, if your body is not good, no woman will like you. You can either choose to have your children circumcised at 1 year and 5 months, but do not go beyond 2.
As I see it, the way God created us, as we procreate, children are born uncircumcised. If they are born with the skin that God sent them with, the same God also gave the intelligence to remove that skin. We remove the skin so that they grow up well. But today, some parents do not care about their children and let them grow up with this skin. How will he be intimate with a woman? Will he have pleasure? We have to cut off the foreskin, remove everything, and let him be normal. So when he has a wife, he can have children and start a family.
Male circumcision and its links to HIV is one of the most talked about issues within the AIDS response community. However, there is still some debate on the benefits.
Here in Kenya, the Luo tribe that lives on the shores of Lake Victoria don't have traditional circumcision ceremonies. Observers say that the rate of HIV infection was far higher than elsewhere in Africa. Since the free circumcision service started in 2008, many men have had the operation.
Ladies, also ask your circumcision status. Besides the HIV status, they ask you, are you circumcised? So when you tell them that you're not circumcised, then you find they develop some question marks, silent question marks on you. So it has very many advantages.
AIDS researchers have observed that many African tribes that circumcise boys or young men have lower HIV rates than those that do not. Furthermore, Africa's Islamic nations, where circumcision is near universal, have far fewer AIDS cases than predominantly Christian ones, according to the report, Male Circumcision and HIV, written in UNAIDS website in 2007.
There were trials done in Uganda, Kenya, and South Africa that proved that circumcision prevented HIV by 60% in men from HIV-infected women.
Scientists believe male circumcision may reduce the risk of HIV infection because it removes tissue in the foreskin that is particularly vulnerable to the virus, and the area under the foreskin is easily scratched or torn during sex. Uncircumcised men may also be more vulnerable to sexually transmitted diseases, which in turn increase the risk of contracting HIV. That's because the region under the foreskin provides a moist, dark place in which germs can thrive.
Compelling evidence that were published in the scientific literature a couple of years ago demonstrated that male circumcision can dramatically reduce HIV infection by 65%. In Africa, very few know how to conduct adult male circumcision in high volume and high quality using a World Health Organization recommended technique, the forceps guided technique.
The forceps guided technique is a method in which, among other things, the scalpel is run across the face of the forceps farthest from the glands to remove the foreskin. The glands, the rounded head of the male sex organ, is protected by the forceps, but the method can't be used for everyone, including adults and boys under 15, because of difficulty identifying the glands and the risks of glands amputation. The United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, released draft policy recommendations in December 2014, affirming male circumcision as an important public health measure.
That was VOA's Jackson Vunganyi reporting. For more on male circumcision, I spoke with Dr. Frank Lule, medical officer with the World Health Organization African Regional Office. Take a listen.
Dr. Frank Lule, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Male circumcision is something that has been practiced for centuries, for ages. Can you explain to us what it entails and why it's important?
Male circumcision, in simple terms, is a surgical procedure, and it involves the complete surgical removal of the male penile foreskin. It's been done for ages, as you said, and in some environments, it's either partial or it's complete.
So what are the benefits in general?
Circumcision has lots of benefits, and I would really start based on the work that I do, that we now have evidence that it protects against acquisition of HIV up to 60%. It's not perfect, but I think it is a very good intervention that we have now. Other benefits include giving young men and adult men a chance to actually engage with health services. As we know, men have very poor health-seeking behavior, and for many of them, we are finding this as actually the very first opportunity to engage and receive other health services, not only for HIV, but for all services that men require. We are also seeing male circumcision protecting against other sexually transmitted infections, really looking at herpes simplex, syphilis, among both men and women, and human papilloma virus. So it is also not just for HIV, but for other sexually transmitted infections. And as you mentioned, it's been used not only for medical purposes, but also for cultural purposes. This is one way people or young men are initiated into manhood. It gives you that self-esteem that you are now a man. So going outside the medical services, I really see that as a great benefit. Lastly, going back to HIV, of all the various HIV prevention services that we have, male circumcision is very cost effective, and it's a one-off. You get it once, you don't need to get it again. For example, if I was to use a condom every time I'm exposed to risky sexual behavior, I would have to put on a condom. For male circumcision, you get it once, and the benefits are for life.
Well, speaking of HIV/AIDS and male circumcision as a way to lower infection rates, there have been studies also showing that some men, after getting circumcised, were not practicing safe sex. So can you clarify that? Because some people would think that when you get circumcised, then you don't have to wear a condom, for example.
Male circumcision provides 60% protection against acquiring HIV. So it is not like what you'd call a magic bullet for prevention. And when we are providing medical circumcision services, we insist on providing a package of services for prevention. Now that includes offering a chance for getting pre-exposure prophylaxis, for example, getting condoms, providing you an opportunity to get to know your status, such as getting HIV testing. And in addition to that, we also provide broader sexual reproductive health services. For example, for you to get to know more information about HIV and other diseases, and also we check for STI, sexually transmitted infections. If you have any, you get them treated. So we provide it as a package, and we must really emphasize that male circumcision on its own is not going to give you full protection against infection.
So what are some of the risks associated with circumcision for men?
Let me start by saying, like all surgical procedures, there is an inherent risk. But fortunately for circumcision, it is a simple surgical procedure, and the risks are really rare. But having said that, when you engage with the recipients of the service, some of the things they mention, interesting enough, what comes number one is pain. But we have bleeding as one of the major risks, most commonly reported. We have infections, which can lead to delayed wound healing. And also in some men, especially black men, they may get scarring, which we call keloids. In very rare events do you get what we call fistulas, and those tend to be really serious side effects that require additional expert surgical restitution. So those are the main risks that we have. And as WHO, we really encourage countries to make sure that this procedure, however simple it looks, it should be provided by a trained health professional. It should be in facilities under aseptic conditions to minimize all risks.
So what about the case where the circumcision is done for traditional reasons? There are a lot of times that doesn't happen in a hospital setting.
Especially in the African region, traditional circumcision is everywhere, let me say. We don't have a lot of data on it, mainly because it's done outside health settings. But it ranges from, say, 20% in Eastern Africa to almost universal in West Africa. And in Southern Africa, for example, South Africa, it is done under secret rituals. And we have people who are taken as traditional circumcisers. And I must say, it's been going on for centuries. And it is really something that is taken as very important in society. And we have seen some risky situations. But by and large, it again comes out as a safe procedure. So we really engage with traditional circumcisers to improve the way they provide their services. We do not completely stop it. And we also encourage them to use the methods that we promote.
And such methods include?
As I said, the real number one method is surgical. You have to actually cut off the foreskin. Modern methods, other methods have been brought where you actually do not use surgical procedure. For example, we have devices that kind of are put around the foreskin, and after a while it peels off. For example, we have the shang ring. They are not widely used, but there are also options that are out there, and they've really been helpful in many ways when we went to scaling up real fast. But the main method is surgical, and what we promote traditional circumcisers is to do it safely under aseptic conditions with a lot of training.
Is there a best age, a best time to do circumcision? Some people do it when they're for babies, whether it's religious or health, hygiene. For various reasons. Some people do it as adults, we talked about traditionally, but medically, is there a best time to do circumcision for men?
Medically, we promote what you'd call early infant medical circumcision. As you mentioned, it can be done in the first months of life. and if done well, it is very safe. And I believe in many societies, including Western countries, that is the method that is used. But we also have the age group amongst adolescents, for example, that ranges from the ages of 10, 20. That is also a safe period, though recent studies have shown that in the ages 10 to 14, the boy's penis is not fully developed. There are higher chances of getting serious adverse events, such as fistulas that I mentioned. So the recent recommendations that we have, we do not include young boys in that age group before 15 years. Main reason is because there are higher chances of them getting the adverse events. Anything above 15 years is safer because the young man is fully developed and it can easily be carried out safely.
Any final thoughts regarding circumcision, whether it's within the African context or in general?
We must keep insisting and recommending this procedure. First of all, it's not under coercion, and that's why we call it voluntary. We add on the word medical to make sure we kind of separate from the traditional male circumcision. So there is the acronym VMMC. So we are promoting is that as one of the key prevention interventions under combination prevention. And countries, especially in high epidemic settings, should continue providing the service. I must say the partnerships that we have had in our region, especially the U.S. government, the Global Fund, and many other multilateral agencies have helped with this procedure. And we have managed to circumcise more than 30 million individuals. And we feel that is a great achievement for the region. And we are encouraging more studies, more research to see how we can even make this a lot safer.
Dr. Frank Lule, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Dr. Frank Lule, medical officer with the WHO African Regional Office. It's time for a short break. On the way, we'll be right back.
Join me on the next Straight Talk Africa when we'll look at Africa's urban future. As the continent continues to urbanize, how will cities accommodate those flocking there and those who are already there? We'll also talk smart cities in Africa. How smart is the idea itself? And we'll hear what you love and don't love about your city. We'll bring you all of that on the next Straight Talk Africa. This Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
Greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young, host of the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in right here, Mondays through Fridays, at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for an action-packed 30-minute program of African, American, and international sports highlights.
Welcome back to Health Chat. We turn now to the COVID-19 pandemic. At least 20 countries across Africa are in the grip of a third wave of COVID-19 infections, according to the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Still, the rates of vaccinations are still very low. VOA's Justin Mullen-Kanzadian has this report.
With the new Delta variant becoming dominant in at least 10 of the 20 countries experiencing a third wave of COVID-19, according to the WHO, less than 2% of Africans being fully vaccinated, and the premature relaxation of restrictions, this surge in cases isn't exactly a surprise, and it could get worse.
In total, on the continent, there have now been almost 5.7 million COVID-19 cases, and 146,000 people, sadly, have lost their lives. New cases have increased for the seventh week running. For Africa, the worst is yet to come as the fast-moving third wave continues to gain speed and new ground in countries.
More vaccines will be available through COVAX in the next few months, but some officials say that's not fast enough.
Let me put it very bluntly. We are not winning in Africa. We are not winning in Africa this battle against the virus. So it really doesn't matter to me at this point whether the vaccines are from COVAX or from anything. What we need is rapid access to vaccines to member states.
Availability isn't the only hurdle. Nations such as Angola and Eswatini made good use of the vaccines received so far, using nearly 100% of their doses, according to the WHO. But many other countries did not and are still fighting issues regarding access as well as hesitancy. Both need to be solved or the waves will keep coming.
So we don't want vaccines to be available and people not taking them, or we don't want people wanted to get vaccinated and not having enough vaccines. The international community need to keep the effort to get the vaccines in Africa, but also local government in Africa need to work on the issue of vaccine hesitancy.
And the mixed messaging isn't helping. For instance, the AstraZeneca vaccine produced in India has been approved by the WHO and been given to many people in Africa, but it's now not being recognized for the European vaccine passport.
The World Health Organization, the EU, the CDC, and also the Chinese, they need to speak the same language. That would help us go out there and convince the people that there is no conspiracy around this vaccine.
The WHO reports that some countries in Africa have yet to receive any vaccines at all. And some experts there say it's an obligation of wealthier nations that have more supplies than they will use to get those vaccines to people who need them. Justine Mullen-Kanzadian, VOA News, Washington, D.C.
Botswana, initially praised for its effort to contain the spread of COVID-19, has seen figures shoot up, with the country now regarded as one of the Southern Africa's hotspots. From Gaborone, Botswana, reporter Mkondisi Dube has the story.
According to Reuters COVID-19 tracker, Botswana is emerged as one of the region's COVID-19 hotspots. The statistics show the country has been recording 527 cases per 100,000 people every day. Last week, the daily average rose to 1,736 infections, the highest since the pandemic began. Botswana has recorded 1,274 deaths, and the vaccination program has stalled because of a shortage of vaccines. In a press statement Friday, the Minister of Health said it had run out of AstraZeneca vaccines, which were to be administered to people waiting for their second shot. Botswana earlier this year indicated it had procured sufficient vaccines to vaccinate the entire adult population. However, in his address to the nation last week, President Mokgweetsi Masisi said the government does not expect some vaccine deliveries until December. He said they now expect to have vaccinated the entire eligible population by the end of 2022.
The global shortage of vaccines is making it difficult for African countries, Botswana included, to vaccinate their populations. It has become even more challenging for some of our fellow African countries to follow up on the second vaccination. We are expecting to receive 50,000 Moderna vaccines and at least 500 doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccines by December 2021. Our plan is to have vaccinated every eligible Botswana and resident by the end of 2022.
In March 2020, President Masisi declared a state of emergency, SOE, to fight the spread of COVID-19. But Dumaboko, leader of the opposition coalition, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, UDC, argues the state of emergency is not serving its purpose.
The state of emergency hasn't served much, if anything at all. It has resulted in wide-scale impoverishment of the people. It has resulted in runaway levels of corruption because of the over-centralization of decision-making. The only thing that would get us out of this problem was a large-scale rollout of vaccines to the general population. And it seems we were lax.
The National Assembly is due to debate the extension of the state of emergency at the end of September. Opposition members and civic organizations have urged Masisi to end it. Masisi last week announced new restrictions, which include closing schools, banning inter-district travel, and the suspension of alcohol sales in a bid to stem the rise in cases. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
Now to Malawi, the country has reintroduced strict COVID-19 measures aimed at curbing surging cases. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The Malawi government has announced it will start inoculating its citizens with several COVID-19 vaccines in an effort to protect more of its population amid growing coronavirus infections. Health Minister Kumbize Kandodo Chiponda says the extra vaccine is necessary to fill a gap. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre. Health Minister Kumbize Kandodo Chiponda says the COVID-19 vaccines Malawi has added include Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, Sputnik, Sinovac, and Sinopharm. Kandodo, who also is the co-chairperson of the Presidential Task Force on COVID-19, says the country is expected to receive a donation of about 300,000 doses each of the Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson vaccines in early August. She says, "We have done this because we don't want to put all our eggs in one basket, as has been the case. That's why we have opened up to include other vaccines which can fill the gaps that would be created." She assured Malawians that the government has independently verified the safety and efficacy of the newly recommended vaccines. Malawi stopped vaccinating its citizens in June when it ran out of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Records show that about 400,000 people have been vaccinated, far short of the 11 million people needed to reach herd immunity. Malawi destroyed about 20,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine, which expired in April. The incineration was largely because many Malawians were reluctant to be vaccinated due to concerns about the vaccine's safety and efficacy. Malawi is expected, however, to receive a fresh consignment of 192,000 doses of the AstraZeneca next week. But Kandodo said the vaccine will be restricted to unvaccinated health workers and those who already have a single dose. She says, "We know there are a lot of people who are now willing to take the jab, but bear with us. Other vaccines are coming, and the importance of Johnson and Johnson is that it's a single dose vaccine. So those who have never taken any vaccines will take these Johnson and Johnson vaccines." Health rights campaigner Maziko Matemba is advising the government to make vaccines available through a standardized program and stop relying on a donated vaccine.
Vaccine has to be part of the routine program so that everyone who wants that vaccine needs to get it. Once you get the right information and you are convinced that this is a vaccine which can support me and save me, I think they should be able to get it, other than maybe having passing almost 2 to 3 weeks without vaccine at all.
Kandodo says the problem Malawi is facing, though, is not about money to buy the vaccine, but where to find it. She said the Malawian government has just received about $30 million from the World Bank to help purchase COVID-19 vaccine. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Vaccine has to be part of the routine program so that everyone who wants that vaccine needs to get it. Once you get the right information and you are convinced that this is a vaccine which can support me and save me, I think they should be able to get it, other than maybe having passing almost 2 to 3 weeks without vaccine at all.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/voahealthchat and let's keep the conversation going. thank you all for joining us today, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lino Humdu in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and wash your hands more frequently, and strive to make every day a healthy day.